Earth Sky.
This is Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Welcome to our 22-minute weekly program of great science and music. I'm Jorge Salazar, and this is a scientist soundbite.
In ancient Maya times, most of the food was produced just locally because it's a tropical lowland and food decomposes, breaks down very easily. So it's hard to ship and transport a long distance. You have to do it on human backs. There's no wheel to use. There are no beasts of burden you could use along the way as well. So it all had to be done on human backs.
Emily Howard is here to tell us more about what you just heard.
Hi, Jorge. That was Dr. Tim Beach of Georgetown University talking about Mayan agriculture. Now, this is a fascinating topic, the perfect marriage of history, mystery, and science. So I'm going to start with the history. The Mayan civilization, it was at its peak over 1,000 years ago in Mexico and Central America, and then it collapsed in the 9th century. And with that collapse came a huge loss of knowledge, which brings me to the mystery, the riddle of Mayan nutrition. Which is to say, most cities were located in environments that were poorly suited to farming, and everything was transported on people's backs. There were no wheels, no beasts of burden. So how did the Maya get food to cities that were far away from good farmland? Now, unfortunately, we still don't know. But in trying to solve this mystery, scientists are studying ancient Mayan agriculture and learning some really cool stuff. I talked with geoscientist Tim Beach about this subject, and he says that one of the ways Mayan people fed themselves was by draining wetlands to create new farmland.
Over the last 20 years, we've been looking at wetlands through the Maya lowlands, which is a region in Central America that runs from Yucatan, Mexico, southward into Honduras. And the most recent work has been on very wet wetlands. We call them perennial, that is, they're wet all the time. The Maya use canals for a number of things. But we think they were using them, in many cases, to drain water away and create more farmland.
Dr. Beach says this farmland was used for all sorts of crops, for maize, for fruit trees, for avocado, and possibly even cacao. And then the canals themselves were harvested for fish, turtle, and mollusks.
What we've found out is that the ancient Maya used a whole lot of things. They didn't have one answer to feeding populations. So we think these things are kind of like the ultimate mosaic of farming uses.
Emily, how did they find all this out?
Well, Dr. Beach and his team were digging trenches 3 meters deep, 10 to 20 meters long, in mosquito-infested swamps. And they were doing this to study the contents of the soil layers. And those soil layers, those are kind of like time capsules to show people how the land was used in the past. Now, in addition to all of this extensive fieldwork, the team was using, and is using, Google Earth to determine where these ancient canals once were.
When you look at these, you find these remarkable groups of rectilinear patterns that in some cases look like spider webs and other places look like more rectangular kind of features. And what they are, essentially, after you look at them, is the product of ancient Maya canals that date back about from 2,000 to 1,000 years or so ago, some of them even earlier than that. And they've changed a lot since that time, but you can still see these patterns. And in fact, you can see them either flying over the region, or you can see them from Google Earth. In fact, we've found a lot more of them from Google Earth in just the last few years.
Something fun to look for on your next computer break.
Cool. Thanks, Emily.
My pleasure.
Earth Sky's Emily Howard. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. And now we bring you a story on post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. On the line is Paula Schnierer, Deputy Executive Director of the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder at the U.S. Veterans Administration. She's here to tell us about the latest science on PTSD as it affects military servicemen and women. Dr. Schnierer, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What do scientists know at this point in 2010 about PTSD and about who gets PTSD and who doesn't?
Well, the first thing we know is that most people exposed to a traumatic event such as combat don't develop PTSD, but that certain factors make a person more or less likely to develop it. probably the most important factor is the nature of the combat or the traumatic event. So the more severe it is, whether someone's injured, how long it lasts, how many times it occurs, increases the risk. Furthermore, what happens after a person's been traumatized also makes a difference. A supportive recovery environment, the absence of stress and further traumas can all be protective. Conversely, returning to further stressors, having additional traumas, marital difficulties, job problems, and the like can make things more difficult. And lastly, even though in chronological order it's the reverse, who a person is going into a traumatic event matters too. The experiences a person has had leading up to deployment to a war zone or any kind of event can make the person more or less likely to develop a PTSD. One factor is the person's age. Up to early adulthood, the younger a person is, the more likely they are to develop PTSD. The more education they have, the less likely. If they've had childhood stressors and trauma, they're more likely.
Well, Dr. Schnur, thank you for speaking with us today. I appreciate it. What's the most important thing that you want people today to know about soldiers and PTSD?
Perhaps there's two. And the first thing is that not all soldiers have PTSD. Even soldiers and other military personnel who have problems readjusting to society, well, that's normal. And coming from a war zone back to a large town or a small town in the U.S. or elsewhere, it can take some time. So your listeners should remember that not everyone returning from Iraq or Afghanistan has PTSD. The second thing is that we have effective treatments. So any of your listeners who are struggling with PTSD, or if they know someone struggling with PTSD, the important thing to know is that those people can be helped.
That was PTSD expert Dr. Paula Schnur. We're taking your questions on Facebook. To find us on Facebook, search for Earth Sky. Sky, a clear voice for science. Deborah Bird joins us now to talk about December meteors. Hi, Deborah.
Hey, Jorge.
So what's happening this month?
Well, there are two dates to remember, December 12th and December 13th. Those are the peak nights of the 2010 Geminid meteor shower. And you might have heard that most meteor showers are best after midnight. That's true of the Geminids as well. But the Geminids is one of the only showers that's pretty good in the evening, too. So if you don't like to stay up late, this is the meteor shower for you.
How many meteors can we expect to see?
Well, the Geminids are one of the best meteor showers of the year. The shower typically produces 50 or more meteors per hour. That's about one every minute. If you watch, you'll find the meteors coming in spurts with lulls in between.
Cool. Lots of meteors. So what are meteors and what causes them to shower?
Jorge, that's a good question. Meteors are sometimes called shooting stars, but they have nothing to do with stars. Instead, they're strictly a solar system phenomenon. Around this time of year, our planet is crossing the path in space of a mysterious object called 3200 Phaethon. And that might be an asteroid or a burnout comet orbiting our sun. All we know is debris from this object burns up in the Earth's upper atmosphere to give us the annual Geminid meteor shower, which, by the way, is visible from all parts of the globe.
And when can people see meteors in December?
That's the nights of December 12th and 13th. And you know, Jorge, they say that if you see even one shooting star or meteor, you can make a wish.
And many people, I'm sure, will be wishing for clear skies that night.
As will I. And a reminder, come to our Facebook page, we're Earth Sky on Facebook, and tell us if you see any meteors.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird. And you can find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org.
Let's work it.
Let's talk it out.
Earth Sky, a clear voice for science, with some weird science now about hamsters with jet lag. Beth Lebwohl is here to explain, do hamsters really get jet lag, Beth?
Well, even though it's kind of funny to think of hamsters flying first class on the red eye from New York to Los Angeles, no, they weren't actually traveling by airplane in this experiment. Scientists just induced jet lag in a bunch of hamsters by advancing their sleep schedules every few days for about a month. In other words, messed with their sleep.
So what about hamsters with jet lag? What are scientists actually studying here?
Well, at a meeting of the Society for Neuroscience in November of 2010, scientists from the University of California presented the finding that in jet-lagged hamsters, the rate of normal neuron birth was halved in a particular part of the brain called the hippocampus. I think another way to say that would be the hamsters' brains weren't performing regular maintenance. And these animals also showed impairment in memory and learning.
So what does this research on hamsters have to do with the jet-lagged person up there?
Well, think about it. Lots of people in this modern world travel for business constantly. They're always shifting their sleep schedules, right? So this study suggests it's actually bad for their brains. Other previous studies have mostly suggested jet lag is bad for the human body.
So how long did the brain impairment in these jet-lagged hamsters last?
Jorge, in a way, that's the most important question. The impairment lasted 28 days after their crazy sleep schedule stopped. And let me tell you this one last thing. Scientists think their brain changes might have had to do with the sleep hormone melatonin, or stress, or cell death. They don't really know. They're still investigating.
Weird Science with Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl. You'll find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Sky, a clear voice for science, we interview the world's top scientists. And now a story about Neanderthals. Neanderthals are humans' closest prehistoric cousins. But how similar are they to us? A new study examined how Neanderthals grew and developed compared to humans using clues from fossilized teeth. Here's Lindsay Patterson to tell us more.
Thanks, Jorge. I spoke with Tanya Smith, an anthropologist at Harvard, and she's the lead author of this study. Her team used powerful x-rays to get a close look at the ancient clues you can find hidden inside teeth. And she said it revealed big differences between ourselves and our Neanderthal cousins.
What we did in our study was we looked at a sample of juvenile Neanderthals from across Europe, from different time periods and from different geographic locations and of different sort of developmental stages. And what we found was that those Neanderthals were actually younger than you would have expected based on modern developmental standards. The interesting thing about their tooth development is that that relates to their overall growth and development. For example, when we look across primates, you know, primates that grow their teeth fast tend to have shorter childhoods and begin reproducing, you know, at relatively young ages, and they tend to have short lifespans. By inference, the fact that the Neanderthals are growing their teeth in a relatively rapid way or over a relatively short period of time suggests that their lifespans may have been abbreviated. They may have been reproducing a little bit, you know, younger than modern humans would have been reproducing. and that their overall growth and development was a little different from our own.
Can you explain how you used fossilized teeth to deduce how fast the Neanderthals matured?
Absolutely. Teeth are a really interesting system because they actually contain tiny clocks inside them. And these tiny clocks register each day of their development as they're being formed. And these clocks don't remodel or reorganize themselves after development. So there's this really beautiful record, sort of like rings in tree trunks, that allows us to read the time, the speed and the time of formation inside teeth.
What does this research add to what's already known about the evolution of Neanderthals compared to early humans? Essentially, what's new here?
What we're doing is finally answering a question that's been debated for over 80 years, which is whether Neanderthals grew and developed just like modern humans did. And if you use just studies of their brain size or their body size, you know, people have argued for a while that they must be just like us because they have big brains and big bodies. And what this research shows using a large sample, or a relatively large sample, is that Neanderthals weren't just like us in this way. And actually, it looks like this may be something that's unique to our own species.
What a difference teeth make in Neanderthals and humans.
Right. If only teeth could talk.
Thanks, Lindsay.
My pleasure.
Earth Sky is Lindsay Patterson. We're taking your questions on Facebook. To find us on Facebook, search for Earth Sky. Earth Sky, heard on 1,500 radio stations around the world. Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl joins us now to talk about lunar greenhouses. What's up, Beth?
Hey, Jorge. It's nice to be here. So in the fall of 2010, scientists launched a lunar greenhouse. But it's not actually on the moon. It's at the University of Arizona. We spoke to Jean-Jacques Melle. He's director of that school's Controlled Environment Agriculture Center. And he said this lunar greenhouse is shaped like a giant cylinder, a tube. It's taller than a human and about 18 feet long, 5.5 meters for you in the world of metrics. It's also collapsible, fully sealed, and relies completely on artificial light. Jacques Melle said a similar greenhouse could help feed astronauts during a manned mission to the moon or beyond in the distant future.
It's a collapsible greenhouse that when it reaches the planet and the spacecraft sets down, the idea is that it expands outward, it opens by itself, and it the hydroponic system is already there, the seeds are in place, and we start it up, turn on the lights, turn on the water, and the plants can begin to grow, even in advance of having the astronauts arrive.
Now, hydroponics just refers, by the way, to a method of feeding plants using just water and nutrients. He said a greenhouse on the moon would need to get its water from the moon itself, and also the recycled waste of humans. That is urine and wash water, but it's safe, he said, if properly cleaned, and it's actually necessary.
The water has to be found on the planet. Fortunately, the spacecraft already have found water, frozen water at least, on Mars. But you don't have an unlimited supply of that water. In fact, you have very little, and it's expensive.
He said that carbon dioxide, which plants need to grow, is also from human waste. It's what astronauts and all humans exhale. Dr. Jacques Melle added that, in addition to getting the right amounts of water and gas in this lunar greenhouse, he would also need to get the right amount of lighting. But because of solar radiation, a greenhouse on the moon would actually need to be placed underground. He said exactly how to get the greenhouse underground is just conjecture at this point. But he knows, theoretically, how he would get the light there. And that would be with fiber optic cables, which you can just basically think of as a light tube.
The light rays will be directed to a fiber optic cable, which is basically a light tube, and it will bring it from above on the surface of the moon or Mars and bring it down to the plants growing beneath the surface. The other alternative is to use photovoltaics, a solar collector that, when it's put in the sun, makes electrical power, electrical energy. And that electricity then is fed to lamps inside the lunar greenhouse and gives the plants the light they need to grow.
So, Beth, lunar greenhouses sound interesting, but what's in this research for us on Earth?
Yes, I asked him, what's in it for me? And he said similar technologies could be used someday in cities, in a greenhouse in the middle floor of a skyscraper, for example.
From skyscrapers to greenhouses on the moon. Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl. That's our show. Thanks for joining us on Earth Sky. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers, Peter Zandam, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Daniel Webb, 100 Flowers, The Boxing Lesson, The Black and White Years, and Monarchs. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, come to our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much hype, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age.